Good evening. A day and a half from now, former special counsel Robert Mueller will go before a pair of House committees and be asked about the Russia investigation. We have breaking news on that tonight. A letter from the Justice Department, which says it was sent at Mueller's request, reminding him not to go beyond the boundaries of his public report. We've also learned through a spokesman that the former special counsel has not shown his old bosses the opening statement he'll give on Wednesday, all of which only serves to add even more drama to the moment. No testimony in recent memory has been so widely anticipated, even though tonight's breaking news notwithstanding, the witness has already made it clear what he will and won't say.
Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
Well, that was the outgoing special counsel a little less than 2 months ago, telling anyone who wants to know his thinking with respect to the investigation to just read the report. At the same time, though, the very fact that he gave that press conference at all, which came as a surprise, signaled something else, as did his earlier letter complaining about how his report was being characterized by the Attorney General William Barr. Both told observers that as little as he liked unnecessary public exposure, he liked people misrepresenting the work of his office even less, which again only adds to Wednesday's drama, the testimony before the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, which Democrats say is necessary even if Mr. Mueller does nothing more than cite chapter and verse from his report. Not everyone has read it all, they say, to which cynics have added not even some committee members, which means potentially that millions of viewers will be hearing some or all of this for the very first time, including the bottom line in obstruction of justice from page 2 of volume 2 of the special counsel's report. And I'm quoting now, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. And they did not so state. Now, we're on tonight for 2 hours, and we'll be devoting a lot of time to the report itself, to the testimony and the significance of this moment. It is a big deal, clearly, even if the man in the White House who tried and failed today to suggest that it's old news and no big deal. Certainly not to him.
No, I'm not going to be watching. Probably, maybe I'll see a little bit of it. I'm not going to be watching Mueller because you can't take all those bites out of the apple. We had no collusion, no obstruction. We had no nothing. We had a total no collusion finding. It said no collusion. The report was written, and the attorney general, based on the report, was easily able to find there was no obstruction. There's no nothing.
Well, keep it honest, as you saw in that key sentence from the report, that is not the conclusion, nor does the report clear the campaign on the question of collusion. In fact, it lays out many examples of the campaign, the president's son, Don Jr., and the president himself welcoming Russian help or interference, some which has never, I repeat, never been part of any presidential campaign before. In addition, the report says, and I'm quoting again, the investigation established that several individuals affiliated with the Trump campaign lied to the office and to Congress about their interactions with Russian-affiliated individuals and related matters. Those lies materially impaired the investigation of Russian election interference. Now, this, of course, speaks to obstruction and perhaps collusion as well, depending on what was being hidden behind false testimony. So none of what the president said about the report is true, and whether he's actually read it or not, he seems to be leaning on Attorney General Barr's initial characterization of the Mueller report, as well as his decision not to bring indictments against the president. As you know, the attorney general's actions and statements have made his impartiality clear, which doesn't seem to concern the president, who is focused on just one individual.
And Robert Mueller, I know he's conflicted. There's a lot of conflicts that he's got, including the fact that his best friend is Comey. But he's got conflicts with me, too. He's got big conflicts with me. As you know, he wanted the job of the FBI director. He didn't get it. And we had a business relationship where I said no. And I would say that he wasn't happy. Then all of a sudden he gets this position. But you know what? He still ruled, and I respect him for it. He still ruled. No collusion, no obstruction.
So again, that second part is untrue, as, by the way, is the first part in order. Let's just take this in order. For Mueller, his best friend is not James Comey. Robert Mueller did not seek the job of FBI director. There was no business relationship nor falling out. what he's talking about concerned Mr. Mueller requesting a refund for the unused balance of a membership from one of the president's country clubs. Literally every single assertion of fact from the president there is not true. It's false, which may be the single best reason to have the hearings on Wednesday, to hear something about all of this from the man in question instead of only the man under suspicion. Joining us now is a member of the House Judiciary Committee who will be among those asking the questions, Democrat David Cicilline of Rhode Island. Congressman, thanks for being with us. First of all, this breaking news tonight, the Department of Justice has instructed Mueller to limit his testimony to what he wrote in his report. Does that affect what you and your colleagues hope to achieve on Wednesday?
No. Look, I think we all understand that Mr. Mueller is likely to limit his testimony to the contents of his report and his investigation. I do think it's sort of curious that the president's lawyers thought it was important to remind him of his commitment to do that and make this sort of ridiculous claim that there's executive privilege attaching to everything else. I mean, think about that. The subject of an investigation claiming executive privilege on the contents of that investigation. It's absurd. There's no basis for that. But I don't think Mr. Mueller intended to go beyond the contents of his report in any event.
So I'm wondering just personally what your strategy is going to be on Wednesday. How do you plan on getting the answers you want, or at least responses you want from the former special counsel?
Well, I think what you'll see from the committee is a very strategic, very sober examination of Mr. Mueller, in which we will allow him to really tell the story of what he found, the evidence he uncovered, the conclusions he made about the president, for example, directing his legal counsel, Don McGahn, to fire the special counsel, to fire Mr. Mueller, that he then directed Don McGahn to lie and say that he never told him to do that, and even directed him to create a false document memorializing that lie for the future. He also will hear testimony from Mr. Mueller about Corey Lewandowski being summoned by the president to the White House and being told to go tell the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, to tell the special counsel to limit his investigation to future presidential elections, not the election of 2016. Those are just two examples of clear obstruction of justice by the president of the United States. I think what you'll hear from Mr. Mueller is a recounting of the evidence in the report that supports the claims of serious misconduct by this president. So, and I think it's going to be incredibly important for the American people to hear it from the special counsel himself who prepared this report and led the investigation.
So essentially what you're saying is you're with the other Democrats sort of coordinating to try to focus on very specific instances and walking Mueller through it because you believe those instances are the most informative in terms of what you believe what went on.
Well, there are 10 specific instances of obstruction of justice allegations against the president. At least five of those, all three elements of that offense are met. So I think you'll see a real emphasis on those five in particular, and then additional questions about the balance. But this is really about the special counsel, really for most Americans, for the first time they will hear the contents of the Mueller report. I mean, most of the American people haven't read the report. I did in its entirety, but that's my job. It's not the job of the American people. So for most people, this will be the first time they will hear what's in that report, what was actually found in this investigation by Mr. Mueller and his team. It's a damning report with really disturbing evidence against the president. And I think it's going to have a very powerful impact on the American people.
You are limited on time, both in how long you can ask questions for, how long you can speak for, and also just the length of time that Mueller is actually going to be sitting for questions. I've heard a number of people express concern that, it is oftentimes members of Congress make an opening statement, and sometimes that opening statement goes on for quite some time. Do you expect that to occur given the time constraints overall that you're working under?
No, I don't think you'll see that. I think you'll see most members go directly to their questions to give Mr. Mueller the opportunity to really speak to the American people and the committee. This is not a hearing which members of Congress should have any interest in highlighting themselves. It's really about giving Mr. Mueller an opportunity to give the American people this important information about what he found. I think you'll see people go quickly to their questions and avoid lots of speeches. I know you'll see that on the Democratic side. We understand from our Republican colleagues that they're going to try the same old, attack the FBI, attack the credibility of Mr. Mueller, bring up Peter Strzok, a bunch of red herrings to really distract from what will be a very damning testimony from the special counsel about the conduct of the president.
Garrett Graff, who's written a book about Mueller and has read or watched almost every minute of public testimony or statement that he has ever given. His top three bits of advice for lawmakers questioning Mueller are, one, the former special counsel is better at this than you are. This is in his words. Two, Mueller doesn't care about what you care about. And three, he doesn't play word games and he's already done your work. Could Mueller, I mean, does any of that ring true to you? Or is that a concern for you?
No, I think that's why Mr. Mueller will be an excellent witness. I think people recognize he's a person of extraordinary integrity. He is very thoughtful and deliberative in his analysis. And really, his responsibility on Wednesday is to report to the American people what he found. You know, he was a great patriot to take on this responsibility. This was an important investigation about the attack of our democracy by Russians and then the president's effort to cover it up. And his responsibility is to share the conclusions of this report with the American people. It's a proceeding which will be serious, where I think people understand the gravity of this moment. But again, I think what he will reveal is really damning evidence that this president engaged in specific acts that would constitute obstruction of justice were he any other person except the president of the United States because of the OLC opinion saying a sitting president can't be charged.
Congressman, if you would just stay with us, I want to bring in CNN legal analyst Kerry Cordero and Julian Epstein, who served as chief counsel for House Judiciary Committee Democrats during the Clinton impeachment. Kerry and Julian, I know you have Julian, I know you have some questions for the congressman. Kerry?
Sure. Congressman, this is Kerry. Assuming that Bob Mueller does what all the indications are that he's given so far, that he's not going to answer the penultimate question of whether, in his view, as a prosecutor, all of the facts that are documented in Volume 2 constitute obstruction. And then if he doesn't answer that question, that doesn't really change the minds of other members of the House as to whether or not there should be an impeachment inquiry. What's that going to say about whether or not Congress is capable of holding a president accountable?
Well, I think Mr. Mueller will certainly say what is in the very end of his report, the final paragraphs, that, in fact, the responsibility to hold a president accountable rests with Congress to vindicate the principle that no one is above the law. And I think Mr. Mueller will reaffirm that on Wednesday. I think we can certainly ask him whether or not the elements of obstruction of justice have been met. And you're right. He will say he's bound by the OLC opinion. But it will be an important time to remind people that 1,000 federal prosecutors signed a letter, and all of them said that if an individual had committed the offenses described in the Mueller report, they would charge that individual with multiple counts of obstruction of justice. So we know the answer to that question, but I think it'll be very powerful to hear it come from Mr. Mueller himself.
Julian?
Well, Congressman Cicilline, in 98, when we were effectively defending President Clinton, it was a lot easier for us to play defense than it was for the Republicans to play offense, particularly when public opinion had shifted against impeachment, as it had done here. Seems to me the Republican playbook is fairly careful to stick with the bottom line conclusions of Mueller, which is that there was no underlying criminal conspiracy and that he will continue to remain noncommittal on the question of obstruction, as I think he probably has to. It seems to me the game that you have to play is to get him to commit to the idea that I wasn't really making a final judgment on some of these legal questions. I was deferring it to Congress. And then you kind of have to get into what are going to be some very graphic details. It's true there wasn't evidence of conspiracy, but that doesn't mean there was an evidence of collusion. There are dozens and dozens of examples of the Trump campaign meeting, discussing, encouraging, and benefiting from criminal Russian interference. And it seems like the job of the Democrats is to illustrate those. And similarly on obstruction, there are a number of kind of important questions you can ask that it can illustrate without forcing Mueller to commit on the question of obstruction that can illustrate that a lot of the activity was obstructionist. How do you intend to do that? What are the things you intend to key on?
Well, I think, you know, we will look at specifically the obstruction of justice offenses that there are 5 of them in which the special counsel found that all 3 elements were satisfied. So I think our focus will be principally on those, although there are five other instances of obstruction of justice by the president of the United States. I think you'll hear some questions about that, the volume one, about the Trump campaign and the contacts with the Russians, welcoming their help, and while not sufficient to establish a criminal conspiracy, certainly unusual to see an American presidential campaign regularly contacting WikiLeaks and the Russians and benefiting from their interference. I think reminding people that what's at stake here is the security of our democracy, and that this was an attack on American democracy, and then followed by the president's effort to cover up and to impede the investigation of the Russian action. Mm. So I think you'll see us go very methodically through the elements of the offense, the conduct of the president. I think you'll hear a lot of questions about what did you find the president did here? What did you find the president say here? So that, again, the Mueller report comes to life. By its contents, the four corners of that document are damning and disturbing and are substantial evidence of wrongdoing. And our only mission is to bring that report to life through Robert Mueller. Right. We don't need to add anything. We just need the American people to understand what he found.
Congressman Cicilline, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you. Carrie and Julian, stay with us. We're going to continue the conversation after a short break. Also later, Thomas Friedman from The New York Times on the president's remarks about him after the op-ed columnist called the president racist, as well as criticism Friedman directs at Democrats who want to win the White House next year. Ahead. Talking tonight, now, as well as in a special hour-long edition later, about Robert Mueller's upcoming testimony. We heard tonight from one of the lawmakers doing the questioning. I want to continue the conversation now with Kerry Cordero and Julian Epstein about what to expect in the testimony itself. So, Kerry, Democrats and the congressman was just indicating the strategy is to focus on areas, particularly those five areas where they think the president obstructed justice, and get Mueller to kind of go systematically through each one. Do you get the sense they're not going to be able to get him to answer the biggest question, which is whether or not Mueller would have charged the president with obstruction of justice if he was not anyone but the sitting president?
Yeah, I think the congressman who was just on, I think he even conceded that point. All indications up until today were that Bob Mueller was not going to answer that question, although there was some sort of, you know, outlying hope that maybe he would go beyond what was the written in the actual report. I think that letter that came from DOJ tonight just puts the nail in the coffin that he's not going to answer that question. So then the question becomes, what can they elicit from him? And on that point, you know, with respect to all the facts that are described, particularly in volume two, obstruction, which is what the Judiciary Committee is most concerned with. And on that, the congressman sounded awfully optimistic to me, and I'm afraid that it's overly optimistic, because Bob Mueller doesn't want to tell a story. He's a reluctant witness. He didn't want to do this hearing. He doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to be there to be able to give the whole narrative and tell the story, and all he's going to need is prompts from the congressman, and then he'll just launch into it. It's going to be really challenging for these members to elicit the information that they want, as opposed to asking him a question and he just gives the most concise possible limited answer that he can.
Yeah, Julian, I mean, do you, you know, the congressman said that he doesn't expect members of Congress who are doing the questioning on the Democratic side to, you know, be making long statements, as often most of them seem to want to do for whatever reason that may be, whether it's getting on the local news or just making a statement and being seen. Do you believe that they will be able to resist that urge and really just get to questioning? Because the time is pretty short on this.
The time is pretty short. And this is a be careful what you wish for moment for the Democrats, because they're going to have two very unsatisfying answers. First, on the question of underlying criminal conspiracy, and second, on trying to get Mueller to commit on the obstruction issue, which I just don't think that he will commit on. So I think they're going to have to limit the opening statements and get to. There's a rich story here about the extent to which the Trump campaign actually communicated and encouraged and benefited from illegal Russian intelligence interference here. And there's a rich story to tell. There's also a rich story, I think, to tell, at least on some of the elements of obstruction. The question is, you know, are they going to be able to persuade anyone? When John Dean testified before the House Judiciary Committee, or the Senate Watergate Committee in 1973, 80 million people watched. My guess is about 15 million people will be watching on Wednesday. Only 21% of the public right now supports impeachment, and the Democratic caucus is divided. So the question is, will the Democrats be able to get into what I think is a rich bounty of material on collusion, which was short of conspiracy, on obstruction, even if Mueller won't commit on it, and kind of tell a story about really odious conduct on behalf of by this administration. Is anybody listening? Can they change any minds? My guess is probably not. And I think we're kind of nearing the end of the impeachment question right now. I don't think that's really viable anymore.
Interesting. Julian Epstein, appreciate it. Kerry Cordero as well. Just days after Robert Mueller testifies, the Democratic candidates for president return to the debate stage. His testimony could become one of the hot topics. But up next, author and columnist Thomas Friedman shows us why he thinks the 2020 field needs to focus and maybe a reset. We'll be right back. Next week, 20 of the top Democratic presidential candidates take the stage in Detroit for two nights of live debates here on CNN. New York Times opinion columnist Thomas Friedman warns that after their first face-off last month, they could be teeing up an easy re-election for President Trump. In his latest piece, Friedman shares what he thinks would be a better strategy for Democrats, though it would may force several contenders to change their message. But the president blasted Friedman for the column in which he labeled the president racist. He suggested that Friedman had kissed up to him during a phone call before that article came out. Thomas Friedman joins me now. Tom, I don't want to give this the juvenile response from the president any more oxygen than it's already gotten, but I do want to give you a chance just to respond what he had to say about you.
Well, you know, the president tweeted about a private conversation we had and lobbed in a few insults. You know, basically, my response, which I put out on Twitter, is that, you know, I was encouraged by a friend of his to speak to him after the downing of the American drone, because I thought it was wise that we not retaliate. And I thought he was wise not to retaliate. And this friend of his wanted me to encourage him in that because he was evidently, you know, agonizing a little over that, not retaliating. And I did that. I began the conversation by saying that, you know, I disagree with you, Mr. President, on many things, but I think you did the right thing on this. He talked for about 4 minutes. We also talked a tad about China, and we left it at that. You know, I believe that when you speak to the president, you should be respectful. I would encourage him to do that as well when he speaks about other people. But you know, the main point was that, for me, understand it's not about him or me. It's about America. And that's why on issues where I've agreed with the president, on China, for instance, or on not retaliating on Iran, I have no problem saying that. And where I disagree with him violently and virulently on issues like labeling four American congresswomen basically as aliens who should go back to another country where three of them were born here, I will speak out as strongly as I can about that. And so that's to me what it's about.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, just on the issue on the four congresswomen and all the things the president has said, it's one of those things that it's hard to know exactly how to kind of day after day report on it, because in some ways there is some strategy involved in his mind. Much of it is, you know, is sort of temporary strategy, or it's just something he says and then it seems to be working for him in his mind and then he continues with it. But I just, from a reporting standpoint, it's an interesting conundrum how not to fall into the trap of just following every tweet that he says and yet at the same time not ignoring, you know, racist language or things which are clearly racist or just many of the things the President of the United States now routinely says.
Yeah, it is a real challenge. I think there's kind of a political response and there's a media response. See, I've been the Democrats, my political response, after obviously denouncing this kind of bald-faced racism by the President of the United States, which is really vile, and denouncing the people in that audience who were shouting, you know, send her back. But once you do that, I think it's very important to use his energy and his leverage against him. What I would have done had I been the Democrats is I wouldn't have put up some impeachment resolution. I actually would have announced a telethon the next day to raise $100 million to register 1 million new Democrats in every swing state and every swing district in America. And every hour I would have sent the president a thank you note that his energy, his vile energy, we've turned into something positive. We've just registered a million new voters. I think if you get into the kind of fight with him where he does his thing and then Democrats and critics in the media just say you're bad, that just doesn't work anymore. It's clear his supporters have made their peace with who he is. They know who he is. The Republican Party is completely rolled over for him. And so we're not going to, there's no new information we can give anyone. I think the only thing you can do is build your leverage to change the one thing that will be totally differentiating, Anderson, and that's removing Donald Trump from the presidency the way he came in by a popular mandate of the American people. That's all I'm focused on right now.
You wrote a really interesting column that I wanted to talk to you about, because you have a lot of people coming up to you saying, you know, he's going to win again, isn't he? I certainly have a lot of people, you know, just saying that to me over, you know, really the last 2 years constantly. Yeah. And you're arguing that the Democratic candidates are not really getting it right, that now is not the right time for a revolution.
Well, you know, I think we have to start with the fact of how did the Democrats win the House back in 2018? They won the House by winning congressional seats in districts that Donald Trump won, carried in the presidential election. And they did that by appealing to independents, moderate Republicans, and suburban women who, for different reasons, had become totally alienated for Trump. To win the presidency, you've got to hold those very same voters while also energizing the Democratic base. I get that. But when you listen to the Democratic debates, and I think when I drill down on people and said, why do you feel Trump's going to win? I kept bumping up against the Democratic debates when they heard people, you know, talking about decriminalizing people who enter the country illegally, that act. And I personally think you should have to ring the doorbell when you come into our country.
That was a position that Julian Castro had an argument about.
Right. And so many people seem to, some people there seem to agree with. I don't think giving away, you know, health care to illegal immigrants is an automatic thing. I think it's something we really better be thinking about, especially when you consider the health care needs and demands of Americans like veterans, you know, for instance. And I think taking away the private health care of 250 million Americans who are one way or another covered by that, I'm replacing it for Medicare with all. That may be a good ultimate goal, but that's something you really want to very gradually build up to. And I think that just shocked a lot of people. It shocked a lot of moderate Democrats. And it certainly was probably a real shock to some of those independents, moderate Republicans, and suburban women whom you're going to need to win. And my main point, Anderson, was this. You want a revolution? I'll give you a revolution. 4 more years of Donald Trump. 4 more years of this kind of aberrant behavior. 4 years in which he could likely appoint 2 more Supreme Court justices under the age of 40. 4 more years of Republicans rolling over for him when he will be unconstrained by any need to be reelected. That will be a revolution. In fact, I think it would leave our country, our norms, values, and institutions in a tatters that I'm not sure would be recoverable for.
Tom, stick around. There's a question Democratic voters are likely asking themselves about the vast field of challengers to President Trump. Do any of them know how to run against President Trump? We'll be right back with Tom Friedman in a moment. Back now with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. He's also the author of the best-selling book, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. Tom, when you look at the Democratic field, you have said that there's an opening for a unifier. How much of an opening is there? I mean, because as we've seen and we're currently seeing, there certainly remains an opening for a divider.
Yeah, judging from the feedback this column got, you know, I think there's just a lot of people out there who really want someone to keep it, I think, basically simple. And to me, the simplest Democratic message is, I think, national unity. I think there are a lot of people around the country, Anderson, yearning for someone who's going to pull the country together. I think there's a lot of people feel like we're like heading for civil war, kind of political civil war. So I think there's a huge yearning for that. And I would say to focus on good jobs, real jobs that come with benefits where someone can actually sustain a middle-class lifestyle, a family of four with rising aspirations. I would keep it very simple around those two things. That doesn't mean if a Democrat wins, they shouldn't pursue all these other agendas. But I think if you really get yourself tied up in all these other things, there's a real danger that in this world with this guy, Donald Trump, who's very effective at smelling out people's weaknesses, going after it, I think you can get tied up in knots. So I'd keep it very simple. National unity and good jobs.
The president does have an extraordinary ability to kind of zero in on a weakness or a perceived weakness and just kind of start needling into it and opening it up deeper and deeper.
Well, and I think the one of the ways to get at his weakness is to say you're a chump. Wait a minute, you moved the embassy, the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and you got nothing for it? No, don't tell me that. You gave away one of the prime diplomatic assets, which we could use to sweeten and leverage an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, and you gave it for free? What exactly have you gotten from North Korea, other than a ceasefire? I mean, Trump the chump does fall off the tongue fairly easily, and there is a lot of evidence for it.
It's interesting, though, because the kind of candidate you're talking about with, you know, not focusing on revolution, a Green New Deal, Medicare, taking away private health insurance, you look at Joe, Vice President Biden on that debate stage the last time, he couldn't come up with an effective argument to defend himself against Kamala Harris on his record. I think there's a lot of people suddenly looking at that and saying, well, you know, let's see how he does, I guess, the next time. But if he can't push back on Democrats to his left or to his right, how's he going to do anything with Donald Trump?
You know, I worry about that. The thing I fall back on, though, Anderson, is that those debates are so awkward. I mean, just so weird. You're up there with, dozen people or however many. You have 4 seconds. People are trying to butt in all the time. I know I wouldn't do very well there, you know. I just want to give this more time. I think it's my bet is you're going to see someone like Kamala Harris move to the middle now. I think some of the stuff that's been revealed in the last few weeks, how Democratic voters actually felt about that debate, there's a big opening in the middle. I think she'll try to differentiate herself, I suspect, from Sanders and Warren. I find a lot of people liking how Buttigieg talks. Like, I like the way he talks about his faith. I like the way he talks about abortion with sensitivity. I like the way he can call out evangelicals for supporting Trump, which part of the Bible justifies this kind of behavior. I think he's a very interesting character. I recognize he comes from a very small town. There's people in there, I think, that in time could really start to, differentiate themselves. I want to just give it time. I don't want to write anybody off yet.
Do you see any candidate right now who, at this stage, knows how to run against Donald Trump? I mean, he eliminated an incredible field of Republicans the last time around. He's willing to go to places that no one else is willing to go. I don't mean like geographical locations. I mean, places, racist places. He has no shame in that regard in terms of how low he might take the debate. Do you see any Democrat who actually really, you think, knows how to run against him?
I see two, Anderson, but neither's available. One's called Bill Clinton and the other's called Barack Obama. But right now, I don't. But I think it's really early. And when you're focused on Democrats against Democrats, very different against Democrats against him in a single race. So I want to give that time.
But you would take lessons from how Bill Clinton got elected, how Barack Obama got elected.
Yeah. You know, Bill Clinton and Obama, again, both had that ability to hold the base, appeal to the center and reach out to the other side. And they also were both quick. They both had rapier wit. They both had a little twinkle in their eye. And they also knew when someone was speaking crazy stuff in a debate, just how to kind of raise their eyebrow and say, like, where did you learn to talk that way?
Tom Friedman, always good to have you. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Anderson.
Up next, more on our breaking news involving Robert Mueller, plus the tale of the tape. Mueller's appeared dozens of times before Congress over the past 2 decades. We'll examine how he conducts himself what we can learn about the upcoming testimony when the heat is on. Back to our breaking news, a letter from the Justice Department, which says it was sent at Robert Mueller's request, reminding him not to go beyond the boundaries of his public report when he testifies on Wednesday. Former special counsel is going to have to navigate claims of executive privilege versus those of congressional oversight. 360's Randy Kaye spent hours sifting through video of his previous testimony for insight into exactly what kind of witness Democrats and Republicans can expect.
The cyber threat has evolved significantly over the past decade.
When Robert Mueller testifies, he's laser focused, never saying more than he has to, never claiming to know more than he does.
Do you have any idea about the percentage of members of, let's say, MS-13, because that's in the news lately, might be here illegally?
I do not. I have to get back to you. But as fairly I really have to get back to you on that.
Mueller has had to face questioning from congressional committees as far back as July 2001. At his FBI director nomination hearing, he showed a rare moment of lightheartedness when asked about FBI managers being required to take polygraph tests.
I have already taken that polygraph.
The only reason I asked that question is I knew you had, and I just think it's important. It's important for people to... Yeah, how did you do?
I'm sitting here. That's all I can say.
I'm sorry.
We just hope you had a good examiner, that's all.
Mueller's testified dozens of times over the years. It's all preserved and cataloged online by C-SPAN. We reviewed more than 10 hours of it. While he is most often precise and polite, he does not like to be pushed around. That was evident in 2013 when Mueller testified about the Boston Marathon bombings.
Why did no one go to the mosque and say, who are these guys? They may attend here. Why was that not done since such a thorough job was done?
Nor does he like to be interrupted.
Your facts are not altogether well.
All right, point out specifically. Point out specifically. Sir, if you're going to call me a liar, you need to point out specifically where any facts are wrong.
We went to the mosque prior to Boston.
Prior to Boston
happening, we were in that mosque talking to the imam several months beforehand as part of our outreach efforts.
Were you aware that those mosques were started by Al-Amudi?
I've answered the question, sir.
Even when things get heated, though, he never raises his voice. It's standard Mueller, calm and cool.
You're asking questions about details of the investigation. I'd be happy to take
that. That is not a detail about the investigation. That took place prior to the investigation started.
May I please finish? You're asking detailed questions about the investigation. I'd be happy to get back to you and answer those questions that I can.
In 2007, Mueller was pressed about a conversation he'd had with former Attorney General John Ashcroft. The topic? A controversial wiretapping program run by the National Security Agency. Mueller, as always, stood his ground, protecting private conversations.
I'm asking you to tell us what the conversation was. I don't think there's a privilege. And I don't want a conversation. I want what's in your psyche. Did you consider it yourself? That's not a conversation. That's a state of mind.
Well, to the extent that I follow through on the state of mind, then it is a conversation. I would resist getting into that conversation.
Despite his rigidness, Mueller has also shown humility, like during this 2013 exchange about surveillance and smartphones, where he admitted he hadn't prepared properly for the questioning.
It's terribly disappointing to come to this point, talk about something that is in the headlines of every newscast. I gave the questions in advance.
And they noted that I would be asked on that, I might add. So it's my fault.
Humility from a man now just hours away from what he hopes will be his last hearing on Capitol Hill. Randy Kaye, CNN, New York.
A lot of experience. Joining me now to discuss Robert Mueller's career and his previous relationship with Congress, someone who worked directly under him at the FBI, John Pistol, who served as deputy director. John, do you expect the Mueller that we see on Wednesday will be any different than the Mueller we just saw in Randy's piece? Very serious, very prepared witness, generally, who's not afraid to push back on lawmakers?
No, I think that's right, Anderson. I think that the piece that Randy teed up will be an example. Those are examples of what he will be testifying like, where he'll be factual, he'll be responsive to the questions, perhaps succinct in those responses, and some may even find that to be terse in terms of short to the point responses. But I think he will try to also refer back to the written report as much as possible, so he doesn't elaborate on that with his opinion or recommendations or things that beyond the scope of the report.
Do you see him actually ending up kind of reading from the report itself?
I could see him doing that if members ask him questions that are directly answered in the report. I could see him saying, well, I've addressed that. The special counsel's team has addressed that in the report. And if he is pressed too much, he may even say, for example, on page 67, you'll find the specific answer to that. And then he may pull that out and read it, perhaps just to delay that or extend the timing of his answer. So limiting other questions and things like that. So we'll see about that.
I mean, it seems like many of the Democrats on the committee would be fine if he is just reading from the report. It seems like what they want is, you know, Robert Mueller on television, even if it's him reading. They feel people will learn something that they didn't otherwise know because most people have not read the report.
Well, that's right. I think I saw something over the weekend said that of those surveyed, perhaps only 2 to 3% of people have actually read the entire report, which is understandable. I mean, it is somewhat dense in places. And if you don't have a legal background or an investigative background, I can see how people could get bogged down. But I think the key would be if Democrats were focusing on what are the big takeaways from volume one and then from volume two, and then in the totality, what are the conclusions? And even if they had him read some of the conclusions that are in the report, that would probably be the first time many people, if not most people, have heard that specific language. Mm.
John Pistol, I appreciate you being with us, John. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Up next, we're going to devote our entire next hour to Mueller's upcoming testimony at Capitol Hill, what his special report said, what President Trump said about it, and the political implications of it all. A big day on Capitol Hill, breaking down the key points made in the Mueller report.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.